releasing two new renditions of Nobel laureate Bob Dylan's Hard Rain. We'll speak with the founder of the Kronos Quartet and with a physicist who helps set the doomsday clock each year, a metaphor for how close humanity is to destruction. Stay with us. Baby, my blue-eyed son. Version of Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall by Kronos Quartet, the Hard Rain Collective, featuring Alison Russell. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. 80 years ago today, July 16, 1945, in the desert of New Mexico, in a place called Alamogordo, the U.S. carried out the world's first nuclear detonation. 3 weeks later, the U.S. would go on to drop atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing at least an estimated 120,000 people. The atomic bombs were developed by the secret U.S. government research program called the Manhattan Project. This is J. Robert Oppenheimer, head of the Manhattan Project, sharing his response to that first nuclear explosion in New Mexico 80 years ago today. He spoke in a rarely seen NBC News documentary produced nearly two decades later.
We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Scientist J. Robert Oppenheimer responding to the first nuclear test 80 years ago today. 3 years before that, in 1942, the University of Chicago was the site of the historic first self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction, a key step in the path to creating a nuclear weapon. University of Chicago would go on to host the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which was formed by scientists from the Manhattan Project who were worried about the risks to civilization from nuclear weapons. The group now sets the doomsday clock each year as a metaphor for how close humanity is to destruction. Well, today, there's a gathering at the University of Chicago to confront the crisis of the increasing risk of nuclear war called the Nobel Laureate Assembly for the Prevention of Nuclear War. That's bringing together Nobel Prize-winning scientists, peace activists, and musicians. It'll culminate with a performance by the Grammy Award-winning Kronos Quartet and the release of two renditions of Literature Nobel Laureate Bob Dylan's A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall that feature the band, the quartet, playing with nearly 50 artists from around the world. This is an excerpt.
Yeah.
Kronos Quartet and the Hard Rain Collective that includes Ringo Starr, Iggy Pop, Alison Russell, Willie Nelson, Laurie Anderson, and so many dozens of other musicians. To talk more about how the Nobel Prize team and the Bolton of Atomic Scientists reached out to the Kronos Quartet with the idea for this project and about this Nobel Laureate Assembly for the Prevention of Nuclear War, we're joined by David Harrington, violinist, founder, and artistic director of the Kronos Quartet, which is focused for over half a century on the intersection of music and activism. Also with us, Daniel Holtz, professor of physics, astronomy, and astrophysics at the University of Chicago, chair of the Science and Security Board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Professor Holtz is also founding director of the University of Chicago Existential Risk Laboratory. He's a co-organizer of the Nobel Laureate Assembly for the Prevention of Nuclear War underway today. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's start with Professor Holtz. The significance of this day. First, of course, the assembly at the University of Chicago, but what happened 80 years ago and why that is so significant in the desert of New Mexico.
Yeah, so first, thanks for having me here and for discussing this on such an important day. The 80th anniversary of Trinity. Trinity was sort of the birth of a new age, and the age of nuclear weapons. And we're still in that age. And the threats that people recognize, that Oppenheimer's quote that you just played kind of captures, they're still with us. We now have thousands of these weapons. They're on high alert. They can go off at any moment. Within an hour, civilization could end. That's still where we are now. And so given that, there's a sense of urgency that we need to kind of step back from this brink. As it's what's sort of hard to understand is here we are 80 years later, and it's ever more dangerous that these weapons are still there threatening us. And so this whole thing is about trying to find a way to kind of move back away from the possibility of nuclear annihilation.
And Professor Holtz, especially now, what's your sense of what our political leaders have learned over these many decades in terms of nuclear weapons? Of course, we have a president now who, when in his first term, withdrew the United States from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, and then, of course, has been risking with his attacks on Iran greater problems in terms of the threats of a possible nuclear war to Iran. Could you talk about what our leaders are learning or have learned?
Yeah, so that's a very important point, which is, and I think all of your audience knows this, the world is becoming much more unstable. There's a sense that things are deteriorating globally in many different avenues, and that makes nuclear exchange, nuclear war, much more likely. And while this is happening, the awareness of the nuclear threat is decreasing. There's so many things to be distracted by that there's a tendency for people to focus on other, very significant threats such as climate change or AI or pandemics. But the nuclear threat is still with us and growing. And I would say probably since the end of the Cold War, it's fallen off the radar, both of the public and of leadership. And that combination of the risks increasing, the world becoming more unstable, and attention to this issue decreasing is particularly alarming because it means the likelihood that we'll sort of stumble into a nuclear war and the end of civilization, that could happen by mistake or miscalculation, has gone way up in the past years to the point where we're so alarmed that we're doing everything we can to kind of draw attention to this risk and try to find ways to mitigate it. And that's the whole point of this Nobel Laureate Assembly were bringing together Nobel laureates and nuclear experts and trying to find a way forward, a way to reduce the risk, get the messages out to the public and also to leaders that here are steps that can be taken to reduce this. We need to get the awareness back, and we need to do everything we can to prevent the sort of nuclear annihilation that would impact literally everyone on the planet. It's in all of our interests to find a way to reduce these risks and these threats.
David Harrington, I'd like to bring you into this conversation, founder of the remarkable Kronos Quartet, violinist yourself. If you can talk about this musical collaboration, everyone from Ringo Starr to Willie Nelson to Alison Russell to your own Kronos Quartet, and people may forget the Nobel laureate, Bob Dylan, Patti Smith, went to receive the award for him years ago. Why did you choose Hard Rain? Talk about the significance back in 1962 of Bob Dylan's hit.
You know, it's remarkable that a 21-year-old singer-songwriter wrote this song in 1962. And how, when you observe and know the words of this song very clearly, how important it is to our time right now. And so when Owen Gaffney from the Nobel Committee asked if Kronos would be interested in reimagining the song, it took me a tenth of a second to say yes. I didn't know how much would be involved in doing what we ended up doing, which is probably a good thing, because we had to do this, on tour. We had to do it to make what we wanted. We needed the whole music community, and we got it. And with Elia Einhorn, master producer, we were able to assemble, I think, musicians that represent humanity in a way that I'm so proud that the music community stepped up. And we get to play tonight. In fact, we're closing the assembly.
That's right.
And, for music to be in that position, I think is a good thing. And I'm so happy to be a part of this. And Daniel is such a leader in our world. And for me, this is something I've wanted Kronos to be a part of for 52 years. And today we are. And I'm very, very happy about that.
And David Harrington, this cooperation between music and also the scientists involved in this assembly, is it your hope to break through what Daniel Holtz is talking about, the lack of attention by the general public to the dangers of nuclear war?
Yes, and the fact that there are very few survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki alive right now, and so the people that know absolutely what it's like to be bombed and be in a nuclear explosion, I think we're forgetting that this actually happened. And so we need those testimonies, and we need everyone in the world to know how dangerous and how awful this is for all of us. And if music and musicians can step up and project those kinds of concerns about all of our futures, then music is doing its job. And what we need to do as musicians is listen. And when I listen to what's happening in the world, it's terrifying. And I want my musical community to do something about it. And this is our first step.
Well, I want to thank you so much. You were just going to say something to Professor Holtz, and then we're going to wrap up.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, it is so important because this brings the public into this, the kind of enthusiasm for this. But it also is part of what makes us all hopeful. It's very inspirational. You listen to the music, you're kind of captivated. It's part of, you know, the glory of humanity. It's what we want to preserve. It's what we're all working for. And so this combination, this way to end the assembly where we're spending 3 days focused on all the bad stuff, all the ways things can go wrong, but also focused on all the opportunities to change course, to make things better, the perfect way to end is with the Kronos. So we're just so excited and honored.
Thank you.
And how do people, David, have access to the song Hard Rain, written in 1962, right around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes. Yeah, it came out, this recording came out in its two forms this morning, and it's released by Red Hot. And I invite everyone to check it out, turn it up loud, and play it proud.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We will link to it at democracynow.org. I want to thank David Harrington, who is the violinist and founder, artistic director of the Kronos Quartet, a part of the Hard Rain Collective, and Professor Daniel Holtz, a physicist, a professor of astronomy, astrophysics, and physics at the University of Chicago, chair of the Science and Security Board of the Bolton of Atomic Sciences. Is co-organizer of the Nobel Laureate Assembly for the Prevention of Nuclear War that's underway today at the University of Chicago. When we come back, as ICE raids terrorize immigrant communities around the country, we'll speak to Teresa Romero. She is the first Latina, first immigrant president of the United Farm Workers of America. Stay with us.
I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken.
And it's a heart.
And it's a heart.
And it's a heart.
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 And it's a heart. Rain's gonna fall.
It's a heart. Rain's gonna fall.
And what did you hear? Brown-eyed son. And what did you hear, my darling young one?
I heard the sound of a thunder.
I heard the sound of a thunder.
I heard the sound.
Roared out a warning.
Hard Rain Drone. One of the two new versions of Nobel laureate Bob Dylan's Hard Rain by Kronos Quartet and the Hard Rain Collective of 50 musicians around the world who are performing on this 80th anniversary of the detonation of the nuclear test in Alamogordo, New Mexico, called the Trinity Test. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in California, where a farm worker who fell from the roof of a greenhouse during an immigration raid last week died over the weekend. His name, Jaime Alanis, 57 years old. He'd worked at the farm in Camarillo for 10 years and provided for his wife and daughter who live in Mexico. His niece says he will now be laid to rest in his hometown of Michoacan. The raid Thursday led to an hours-long confrontation between protesters defending the workers and federal border agents who tear-gassed crowds, which included children. Alanis is the first known person to die in an immigration raid as part of Trump's crackdown. A fundraising campaign for his family has raised more than $150,000. More than 360 people were arrested that day in dual raids and the coast, both in Camarillo and the coastal city of Carpinteria. As raids terrorize immigrant communities, people are also organizing and fighting back. We're joined now in Kern County, California, by Teresa Romero, longtime labor leader, first immigrant Latina president of United Farm Workers of America. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Teresa. It's wonderful to have you with us. If you can talk about this moment in history, we don't know how many hundreds, if not thousands, of farm workers have been detained, as many people say, kidnapped. If you can tell us what the situation is now, President Trump pulling back 2,000 National Guard in Los Angeles, but leaving 2,000 there, not to mention somewhere around 700 Marines. If you can tell us what the situation is and how you're organizing.
Thank you very much for having me, Amy. I really appreciate it. This is such an important issue. Farm workers in our communities are terrified. We have families who are being destroyed. Like you said, Juan Alaniz Garcia died as a result of these raids. And we need to understand that I have been using this word kidnapping for a long time because people are showing up, are wearing masks. They don't have an identification that they're showing to the workers. They have unmarked vehicles. They were there in great numbers. And if they had had a search warrant or an arrest warrant, all they needed to do was knock on the door and would let them in, and they would have been arrested, the person that we're looking for. Unfortunately, the way they did it was to intimidate people, to intimidate farm workers, and it worked. Farm workers are terrified right now.
And what is happening in terms of the agricultural industry as a whole with these raids and with workers even being able to show up in the fields?
You know, Juan, what happens is when something like this occurs in their communities, they may not go to work for a day or two, maybe three. We need to remember that farm workers do not make a lot of money. A lot of them are seasonal workers, so they cannot afford to not go to work. They have a family to support. Right now, that's pretty much all they do, go to work and come home. And every time they leave their homes, they're terrified, not knowing if they're going to come back. And their children, who in many cases are U.S. citizens, are terrified to go to school because they don't know if mom and dad are going to be home when they get back.
And the Trump administration seems to be just reacting to what the agribusiness industry's economic concerns, but the farm workers are being left out of any discussions here as to possible next steps by the administration in handling farm labor. Could you talk about what your union would like to see?
Of course. And for many years, for decades, farm workers have not had a seat at the table. The previous administration, thankfully so, we did, but it's going back to where farm workers' voices are not heard. What they're trying to do right now is deport and replace. They want to deport farm workers who have been working in the fields, putting food on our tables for decades, and want to replace them with workers who come here with the H-2A visa program. These farm workers are even more vulnerable because they're under 100% under the control of the employer. So this is not the answer. Replacing people who are experienced, who are professional, who have been in agriculture working sometimes for decades, three, four decades, it is not how we should repay them for the sacrifice and hard work.
I want to turn to Flor, a Mexican immigrant who picks strawberries in the agricultural town of Oxnard, California. Yesterday, we interviewed the mayor of Oxnard. She says the recent immigration raids have terrorized her community. She talks about her work.
Yes, lately it's been very ugly at our job site because we were working and the immigration cars are passing by. It has affected us a lot at work. We have lost days without going to work. We have been stressed out, afraid to go out to work in the mornings, with fear of not knowing if we're going to get home or not. Well, I'm more afraid because I'm a single mother, and I have three children who depend on me. And it breaks my heart that every time I leave the house, they tell me, Mommy, be careful, because they can take you and send you to Mexico, and we're going to stay here without you.
That's Flor, a farm worker in Oxnard. She says she's paid $3.20 for a 20-pound box of strawberries. Can you talk about the conditions and the economics of being a farm worker, and then talk about children?
You know, the conditions in the fields are very difficult. In California, there are areas where the temperatures can get to 120, 150 degrees, and the workers are toiling the fields no matter what. They are bending over. They are picking whatever crop they keep picking. They run, for example, tomatoes. They run to a truck to dump the buckets, and they run back again and do it all over again. This is something that is dangerous. Workers have died because of heat illness. We have fought very hard right now, and we have filed lawsuits to prevent the administration and ICE from detaining people just because of the work that they're doing, the language that they speak, the color of their skin. And the judge agreed with us. The judge gave us a temporary restraining order. Of course, the administration saying that they're going to deport it. They're going to fight it. But it is just unfair that good, hardworking people are being targeted like this. They're not criminals. They're not criminals, and sooner or later, the agriculture industry is going to suffer. When it comes to families, you know, like I said earlier, farm workers are going to work and coming back home. They don't go out to the park with the kids. They don't go to school functions with the kids. They don't take the kids on a weekend for a hamburger. It is affecting themselves, their family, and their communities to a great extent.
I wanted to ask you, Teresa, there are some farm worker advocacy groups, for instance, like the group Somos Poder del Pueblo, We Are the Power of the People, that are calling for a more militant response, possibly a nationwide strike of farm workers in response to Trump's attacks. And they've circled the dates of July 16th to the 18th. What is the United Farm Workers' view of this this kind of action at this point?
Involved in this action. You look, we empower workers to do what they think it is the best thing to do to protect their rights. We know from experience, and you know our history, that a strike takes a lot of discipline, a lot of work and engagement, a lot of commitment, and a lot of time to plan and organize. So although we see what they're doing, this is not something that we're involved. If we were ever get to a point where we're going to do that, it would take a lot of planning, looking at the pros and cons under the circumstances. So all I'm asking is whoever's going to be out there to just be careful. We don't want these people that are fighting for others to be retaliated against and detained by
ICE. Teresa Romero, we want to thank you for being with us, longtime labor leader, president of the United Farm Workers. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
Are you someone or know of someone who is affected by vision loss? The BC Yukon Division of the Canadian Council of the Blind, or CCB, is a group run by the blind for the blind. From technology training to public awareness to, most importantly, peer support, these are just a few services they offer to help their members achieve their full potential. Come see how we can raise their potential more by visiting ccbbcyukon.com.